Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Loan forgiveness could spur people to return to higher ed. University of Texas Permian Basin officials are not sure how the Biden administration's loan forgiveness plan will impact students, but they suspect it will be beneficial. Senior Vice President of Student Affairs and Enrollment Management, Becky Spurlock, said while it was clear what Biden intends to do, the way it rolls out will come from the U.S. Department of Education, and they had not released any details yet. Spurlock and Assistant Vice President of Enrollment Management and Director of Financial Aid, Scott Lipinski, could talk about what they expect, but they were waiting for the bigger picture. Last month, President Biden announced the administration's plan to give working and middle-class Americans more breathing room by providing up to $20,000 in debt relief to Pell Grant recipients and up to $10,000 to other borrowers, a White House news release said. The Biden administration expects that over 40 million borrowers are eligible for its student debt relief plan, and nearly 20 million borrowers could see their entire remaining balance discharged. The student debt relief plan will help borrowers and families recover from the pandemic and prepare to resume student loan payments in January 2023. Nearly 90% of relief dollars will go to those earning less than $75,000 per year, and no relief will go to any individual or household in the top 5% of incomes in the United States. By targeting relief to borrowers with the highest economic need, the administration's actions are also likely to help narrow the racial wealth gap. Nearly 71% of Black undergraduate borrowers are Pell Grant recipients, and 65% of Latino undergraduate borrowers are Pell Grant recipients. There are also income-driven repayment plans and many other provisions. I think without knowing the details, the main idea of loan forgiveness, particularly the way that the president constructed it around amounts being for income sensitive and related to Pell eligibility, means that our particular profile of students, many of them, if not most of them, would meet the $20,000 forgiveness. Given that our overall loan debt average for students here is below that, it has the possibility of having a very tremendous and positive effect, Spurlock said. Lipinski said it covers graduate school loans too. Spurlock said there is a lot they don't like, whether forgiveness will apply to current students or will it only apply to people once they are done with school. If they had direct loans, they can get those consolidated, and then those can also be part of their forgiveness, Lipinski said. Asked if students take out multiple loans, Lipinski said it depends on if the student has reached their federal loan aggregate limit. In that case, they may take out a private loan from a bank to pay for the rest of their education. Sometimes people have good enough credit to where their interest rate on the loan from a bank is actually less than a federal loan, Lipinski said. Spurlock said there is a lot of talk about the current loan forgiveness announcement, but loan forgiveness has been in place for a number of years in various forms. Spurlock said those programs were largely connected to certain fields of service. Lipinski said you could get a loan discharged because of permanent disability, and public service loan forgiveness has been in place since about 2010. I think what has happened in the last year has been that there was an expansion and reconsideration regarding the public service loan forgiveness program because it wasn't meeting its original intended purpose, and it was expanded quite a bit, Spurlock said. Between this and the latest forgiveness program, they will apply to many, many more people than were eligible before. Debt accumulation depends on the type of school someone attends, how much it costs, and how loans are provided to students. Private schools tend to have higher tuition and fees, Lipinski said. As a first-generation college student, Spurlock said she took out the maximum amount of loans she could get her hands on. I did okay in high school, but I didn't come out as an academic superstar. I didn't have merit scholarships. And while I didn't qualify for some of the loan programs or some of the programs you get when you're really needy, it was not because I wasn't, but because I didn't meet some of the legal definitions, Spurlock said. With no adults helping her, she said she's sure there were times she took out more money than she needed, but she didn't know how much things were going to cost. Spurlock went to school for a long time, but had a low-wage job when she graduated, so she wasn't able to make the dent in her payments that she needed to. Students who don't complete their degree wind up in a really tough situation because they've accumulated debt on the idea that they're going to be able to make more with a degree, but then they don't finish it. Now here at UTPB, our overall loan debt on average is less than half of what the national debt is, Spurlock said. The average national student loan debt is about $37,000, she said. Spurlock said UTPB's low loan debt is due in large part to its low cost. We work very hard to keep our costs low. Lipinski said sometimes older students use their loans to help supplement their income because they may have had to cut back on their workload. It's fair to say that people take out loans to pay for their education, but often they're just trying to pay for their lives, and often that might be a source of income for the whole family. Lipinski said when he got out of the Navy, he was used to making a certain amount of money, but then he and his wife went to school at the same time, and he was working at a Subway. He used his loans to help supplement his income. Spurlock said she thinks many people will want more details on the forgiveness program to understand it. But I do think that this will overall encourage more participation in higher education. I think there will be people who, for example, now that they have some debt forgiveness, that they will now be able to say, okay, now I have the ability to go back and get a master's because I can pay for that. But I couldn't pay for it while I was also paying for my undergraduate loans. Or if people have loans but don't get a degree, they may gain the capacity to go back to school. Spurlock said it may also spur those who haven't gone to college yet to go for it. Obituaries and death notices from the Odessa American for Wednesday. Manuel Antonio Tony Carrasco, 54 years old, passed away on Sunday, September 18th at MCH. Tony was born on June 29, 1968, in Presidio, Texas. Tony leaves behind a beautiful daughter, Brittany Alvarado, along with her mother, Delma Alvarado, girlfriend Nancy Machuca, and her daughter, Ava Machuca. His parents, whom he loved with all his heart, Eulogio Carrasco, Olga Carrasco, siblings Dieta Lanas and husband Jose Lanas, Eulogio Jr. Carrasco and wife Linda Carrasco, Laura Lujan and husband Auden, his nephews and nieces. A visitation for Manuel will be held Thursday, September 22nd, from 2 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Odessa Funeral Home in Odessa. A second day of visitation will occur Friday, September 23rd, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. in Odessa. Funeral services will occur Saturday, September 24th at 10 a.m. at Odessa Bible Church in Odessa. Burial will follow in the Sunset Memorial Gardens Cemetery in Odessa. Jake C. Collins, Jr., 91, of Odessa, passed away on September 7th in Odessa. Memorial services will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, September 24th at Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home with Pastor Glenn Anderson of Methodist Church of Crane officiating. Jake was born in Commerce, Georgia, to Jacob C. Collins, Sr. and Molly Collins on June 9, 1931. Jake is preceded in death by his parents, his sister Catherine Anderson, and granddaughter Jennifer Leanne Collins. Jake is survived by his wife Gwen Collins, son Kirk Collins of Odessa, daughter Michelle Anderson, and her husband Glenn of Crane. Grandchildren and nephews. To send condolences to the family, please sign his guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. On Thursday, September 15th, 2022, Melba Francis Munoz gained her wings at the age of 74. Melba was born in Pecos, Texas, July 9, 1948, to parents Sista and Pablo Granado. Preceding her in death is her mother and father and daughter Josephine Jimenez. She leaves to cherish her memories husband Jose Antonio Munoz Sr., Tony, sister Leah Venegas of Odessa, daughters Diana Frances Munoz of Round Rock, Texas, Maria Cristina Christy Leal and husband Arthur of Odessa, Cindy Munoz Morgan and husband Scott of Cedar Park, Texas, Rachel Michelle Bunch and husband Justin of Midland, Sarah Elizabeth Friel of Odessa, sons Jose Antonio Munoz Jr., Joey of Odessa, Michael Paul Munoz of Odessa, Stephen Victor Munoz and wife Laura of Odessa, 22 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. A visitation for Melba was held Tuesday, September 20th at Odessa Funeral Home. A rosary occurred Tuesday, September 20th. A funeral mass will occur Wednesday, September 21st at 10 a.m. at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Odessa. A burial will occur Wednesday, September 21st at Ector County Cemetery in Odessa. Funeral services for Dolores Lola Urquieta Rivera, age 90, of Seminole, will be held Wednesday, September 21st at 2 p.m. at South Seminole Baptist Church with Pastor Hector Manares and John Roy Ball officiating. Burial will follow at Gaines County Cemetery, all services under the direction of Boyer Funeral Home. Mrs. Rivera was born on June 15, 1932, in Terlingua, Texas, to Mauricia Martinez and Juan Urquieta. Lola Rivera went to be with her Lord and Savior on September 16th at her home in Seminole. In addition to her parents, she is preceded in death by her beloved husband, Benjamin Rivera Sr., one sister, Andrea Villalva, and 3 brothers, Anastasio Sanchez, Vicente Urquieta, and Jose Maria Gutierrez. She is survived by 2 sons, Benjamin Rivera Jr., and wife Merlinda of Arlington, Texas, and Stephen Rivera and Lyle Bachman of Phoenix, Arizona. 3 daughters, Maria Luisa Rivera, Lotito and husband Aldo of Odessa, Yvette Rivera of Phoenix, Arizona, and Yvonne Sperry and husband Jeff of Fort Worth. 4 grandchildren, 3 sisters, Maria Molinar of Odessa, Catalina Bermudez of Alpine, Texas, and Hortensia Cordova of Alpine, and many nieces and nephews. Joyce Faye Lowe, 68, of Odessa, died Thursday, September 15th, in Odessa. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Delmar Jean Crane, 81, of Odessa, died Monday, September 18th, in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 1 p.m., September 23rd, at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Pastor Lindell Lee Sr. is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Gerald Robert Driver, 60, of Odessa, died Saturday, September 17th, in Midland. Memorial service is scheduled for 1 p.m., September 24th, at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Pastor Billy Reyes is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Christina Gonzalez, 66, of Odessa, died Thursday, September 15th, in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 10 a.m., September 22nd, at Odessa Funeral Home. Burial to follow at Greenwood Cemetery in Pecos. Arrangements are by Odessa Funeral Home of Odessa.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram Health and Wellness for Wednesday, September 21st, 2022. MMH shines light on fall prevention. Midland Memorial Hospital's Fall Prevention Awareness Week began Monday, promoting fall prevention not only for our patients and employees, but also for our community. sharing techniques, resources, and education. A fall is a major issue in healthcare organizations. Midland Memorial Hospital has a staff dedicated to preventing falls that can drastically change patients' level of functioning and quality of life. As most falls are preventable, MMH has implemented a fall prevention program that aims to prevent falls and gives patients the best care in Texas. The fall prevention coordinator plays a significant role in providing evidence-based interventions for fall prevention, such as hourly rounding, awareness for a risk of a fall, and education staff on fall precautions. Another resource available for aiding nurses with patient safety is placing a patient monitoring camera in the room when needed. These cameras are monitored by patient care assistants who can communicate to a patient to not get up until help arrives or alert medical staff to prevent these types of falls. A fall at home can be just as life-altering. For older people, a break can be the start of more serious problems, such as a trip to the hospital, surgery, or even a disability, causing the individual to need long-term facility care. A fear of falling becomes more common as people age or with individuals who may have other health issues. For many, the fear may lead people in our community to avoid activities such as walking, shopping, or other social activities. Overcoming this fear can be challenging, but can be accomplished. Many studies have shown maintaining your physical health and staying active as much as possible can be a major deterrent in a fall. Strategies to help with fall prevention. Know the side effects of medications you take. Start an exercise program to regain balance and strength. Take a look around your home for potential fall hazards. This can make your surroundings safer and easier to navigate. Secure loose rugs and immediately clean spilled liquids, adding non-slip mats to your bathtub or shower. Light up your living space, placing nightlights in your bedroom, bathroom, and hallways. Store flashlights in easy-to-find places in case of power outages. Using assistive devices such as handrails on stairways or showers and tubs, and raised toilet seats with armrest may also aid in preventing a fall. Try doing simple things you enjoy, like getting together with friends, gardening, walking, or going to the local senior center for social and physical activity. If you have fallen in the past, please see your healthcare professional who can recommend any other assistance you may need to get back to a healthier you. Panel: U.S. adults should get routine screenings for anxiety. U.S. doctors should regularly screen all adults under 65 for anxiety, an influential health guidelines group proposed Tuesday. It's the first time the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has recommended anxiety screening in primary care for adults without symptoms. The proposal is open for public comment until October 17th, but the group usually affirms its draft guidance. The recommendations are based on a review that began before the COVID-19 pandemic, evaluating studies showing potential benefits and risks from screening. Given reports of a surge in mental health problems linked with pandemic isolation and stress, the guidance is, quote, very timely, end quote, said Lori Burt, a task force member and co-author. Burt is a psychologist researcher at the University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School. The task force said evidence for benefits, including effective treatments, outweighs any risks, which include inaccurate screening results that could lead to unnecessary follow-up care. Anxiety disorders are among the most common mental health complaints, affecting about 40% of U.S. women at some point in their lives, and more than 1 in 4 men, Burt noted. Black people, those living in poverty, people who have lost partners, and those who have other mental health issues, are among adults who face higher risks for developing anxiety, which can manifest as panic attacks, phobias, or feeling always on edge. Also, about 1 in 10 pregnant and postpartum women experience anxiety. Common screening tools include brief questionnaires about symptoms such as fears and worries that interfere with usual activities. These can easily be given in a primary care setting, the task force said, although it didn't specify how often patients should be screened. Midland Health to hold COVID booster clinic. Midland Health will hold a COVID-19 Omicron booster vaccine clinic from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. September 28th. The clinic will take place at the F. Marie Hall Outpatient Center, 4214 Andrews Highway. This clinic is for patients 12 years and older who have already received the primary series. This clinic is for the Pfizer COVID-19 bivalent booster only, not the primary series. Recipients of the Pfizer COVID-19 bivalent Omicron booster must have received their last dose, including first or second booster, at least 2 months before to be eligible for the bivalent booster. Recipients must bring their U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention COVID-19 vaccination card, showing at least 2 completed doses to receive the vaccine. Pre-registration and an appointment are required. As of Tuesday morning, Midland Health was reporting 3 COVID patients in Midland Memorial Hospital. Talk to loved ones about assisted living. Suggesting assisted living to your loved ones can be a very difficult conversation. It may take time for older adults to come around to the idea of assisted living, so avoid pushing them too hard and make a strong effort to ensure they feel safe and comfortable. A Baylor College of Medicine expert explains how to have the assisted living talk with older parents and loved ones. Quote, start the conversation as early as possible and focus on what matters, end quote, said Dr. Angela Caddick, geriatrician and associate professor in the Roy M. and Phyllis Gaw Huffington Center on Aging at Baylor. Quote, think about if an assisted living environment could not just support, but enrich things that really bring joy to that individual's life, end quote. As adults age, the responsibility of maintaining a home and a yard becomes onerous. The assisted living conversations often develop once adult children notice the burdens their parents carry. The death of a partner may result in an individual feeling alone and losing their social connection. So discussing assisted living also could be a consideration after losing a partner. When approaching the conversation with a loved one, Caddick suggests having some facilities in mind, whether you visit them in person or research them online. Presenting options that are close to their home or with facilities near where an adult child lives if they would consider moving. Being mindful of their feelings if they are resistant to moving to another city close to their adult child. They cannot be expected to acclimate immediately. Asking them if they have friends who have made a similar move and normalize that change is difficult. Involving them as much as possible in the decision and encouraging them to tour facilities with you. Quote, find a place they feel good about, too, and bring some of their belongings, end quote, Caddick said. Quote, it's typically a major downsizing of space, but it is important to bring things that have meaning to them and make it feel like home as much as possible. This may include items like a favorite chair, items they need to engage in a favorite hobby, or family photographs, end quote. If an older adult refuses, do not keep pushing unless you feel there's a safety issue. Come back to the conversation later and ask if they had the opportunity to think about the idea any further. Events such as hospitalizations or natural disasters also can be a logical time to reconsider the idea of assisted living. Take the opportunity to tell them, quote, I'm glad it went as well as it did, but it could have gone differently, so let's revisit this so you can be in a place with support, end quote. Caddick encourages finding a facility that suits their needs and digging deeper. While a place might look nice in the lobby or during the tour, learn more about their offerings. Get to know the staff and find out about turnover. Some facilities might have a community of veterans or other special populations that are appealing, while others offer, quote, university, end quote, for the residents who enjoy and thrive on learning. Quote, go beyond the beautiful fresh flower bouquet in the lobby because this is going to be someone's home, not a hotel they're staying in for a couple of nights, end quote, Caddick said. Quote, you're looking for a feeling of home and fitting in with other residents and a staff that feel like family, end quote. Study. Losing weight could help protect your knees from arthritis. Weight loss may help prevent the development and progression of knee osteoarthritis by as much as 22%, according to research published in the journal Arthritis and Rheumatology. That was the benefit found in study participants who lost enough weight to drop from one body mass index, BMI, category to another, from, quote, overweight to, quote, healthy weight, for instance. The study included 9,762 participants whose knees were x-rayed and tracked for 4 to 5 years. Osteoarthritis, which affects the joints and is considered the most common type of arthritis, is often thought of as a, quote, wear and tear, end quote, disease. It develops when the cartilage that acts as a cushion between the bones in a joint breaks down or wears away, leaving the bones to rub together and cause pain, stiffness, and movement issues. The researchers noted that even study participants who lost less weight still achieved, quote, protection against structural degeneration of the knee, end quote. The benefit of weight loss was found to apply not just to those who were overweight or obese, quote, but also in people with a BMI in the normal range, end quote, they wrote. For example, those whose BMI dropped just one unit to a lower number on the BMI chart, from a BMI of 19 to 18, for instance, we're still about 5% less likely to either develop osteoarthritis or have existing osteoarthritis worsen. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than 32 million U.S. adults have some type of osteoarthritis. Although the knees are the joints most often affected, osteoarthritis can develop in joints in other parts of the body as well, such as the hands, hips, neck, and lower back. Subarachnoid hemorrhage can lead to permanent brain damage or death. Globally, 1 in 4 people over 25 will have a stroke of some form, according to the World Stroke Organization. Subarachnoid hemorrhages account for about 1.2 million cases of stroke each year, and nearly 40% of those cases are fatal. While not the most common type of stroke, a subarachnoid hemorrhage can lead to permanent brain damage or death. Quote, it mainly happens because of arterial bleeding on the surface of the brain, end quote, says Dr. Ruby Tok, a Mayo Clinic neurosurgeon. A subarachnoid hemorrhage is often linked to an aneurysm. Bleeding increases pressure around the brain, which can cause a sudden severe headache sensation, a person to lose consciousness, and brain damage. Quote, it happens unannounced, and most people who come to us have no symptoms before, end quote, says Dr. Tok. Surgeons must first stop the bleed. In cases where fluid does not drain, a device is inserted to help. This device monitors and alleviates pressure in daily management of this complex disease. Watch for changes in headaches and other stroke-like symptoms, such as slurred speech or weakness on one side of the body. Quote, we want them to call doctors or seek medical attention to have the appropriate workup and make sure that's not a red flag for an aneurysm that's imminent for rupture, end quote, says Dr. Tok. Out-of-control STD situation prompts call for changes. New York. Sharply rising cases of some sexually transmitted diseases, including a 26% rise in new syphilis infections reported last year, are prompting U.S. health officials to call for new prevention and treatment efforts. Quote, it is imperative that we work to rebuild, innovate, and expand STD prevention in the U.S., end quote, said Dr. Leandro Mena of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in a speech Monday at a medical conference on sexually transmitted diseases. Infection rates for some STDs, including gonorrhea and syphilis, have been rising for years. Last year, the rate of syphilis cases reached its highest since 1991, and the total number of cases hit its highest since 1948. HIV cases are also on the rise, up 16% last year. And an international outbreak of monkeypox, which is being spread mainly between men who have sex with other men, has further highlighted the nation's worsening problem with diseases spread mostly through sex. David Harvey, executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors, called the situation, quote, out of control, end quote. Officials are now working on new approaches to the problem, such as home test kits for some STDs that will make it easier for people to learn they are infected and to take steps to prevent spreading it to others, Mena said. Another expert said a core part of any effort must work to increase the use of condoms. Quote, it's pretty simple. More sexually transmitted infections occur when people are having more unprotected sex, end quote, said Dr. Mike Sag, an infectious disease expert at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Syphilis is a bacterial disease that surfaces as genital sores, but can ultimately lead to severe symptoms and death if left untreated. New syphilis infections plummeted in the U.S. starting in the 1940s, when antibiotics became widely available. The arrival of monkeypox added a large additional burden. CDC recently sent a letter to state and local health departments saying that their HIV and STD resources could be used to fight the monkeypox outbreak. But some experts say the government needs to provide more funding for STD work, not divert it. Harvey's group and some other public health organizations are pushing a proposal for more federal funding, including at least $500 million for STD clinics.
High cholesterol with low calcium lessens risks to your good health for Wednesday. Dear Dr. Roach, I'm a 61-year-old white woman who is 5'5 inches tall and weighs 150 pounds. I walk 2 miles just about every day and easily hit more than 10,000 steps almost every day. I have never smoked. I do not have high blood pressure. However, I have very high cholesterol. Here are the numbers of my last reading in February. Total cholesterol was 288. Triglycerides was 119. HDL cholesterol was 69, VLDL cholesterol was 21, and LDL was 198. All other measurements of blood and urine factors are within normal ranges. I took atorvastatin and had a full-blown allergic reaction, and I had a reaction to pravastatin as well. Niacin caused severe muscle pain for me. My doctor's office referred me to a cardiologist. My calcium score was zero. I have no family history of heart issues. I'm now taking fish oil and ezetimibe, but the cardiologist implied this is of almost no value. The cardiologist has suggested he may wish to prescribe Repatha or Praluent. When I asked him the risks of those medications, he said there were none, except the possibility of a tough, itchy spot at the injection site. I don't believe this, and in fact, this cardiologist did not inspire confidence in me. Should I consider one of these drugs? Dr. Roach writes, your cholesterol levels are high, and with an LDL above 190, most authorities do recommend treatment. However, you have a high to normal HDL cholesterol and no family history, which reduces your risk. You have a calcium score of zero, which also significantly reduces your risk. The cardiologist is using his best judgment, but given your combination of risk factors and protective factors, I think it would be helpful to get some aid in doing a formal decision analysis using an algorithm to estimate risk.
This is the Dear Abby column. While wife was away, husband discovered women's clothing. Dear Abby, my wife has been away for a while caring for her ill parents. Because I was alone, I decided to experiment with wearing women's clothes and found that I really enjoyed wearing leggings. They make very comfortable pajamas. I also found that sports bras not only provide compression that feels good, but also serve a purpose because I have rather enlarged breasts. Should I hide everything and put away my leggings and bras, or should I let her in on some of my secrets? Signed, Dressed Up in California. Dear Dressed Up, I'm not sure what other secrets you have been hiding, but if they involve cross-dressing, you're not the only man who has discovered he enjoys wearing women's clothes. It may surprise you to know their wives help them do it. Your reasons for wanting to wear a sports bra and leggings seem practical. I see no reason to try to hide it from your wife. Dear Abby, I'm a widow. I totaled my car 4 months ago and asked a friend, Stan, for the type of help my husband would have provided. Stan was great and did so much. I felt bad that he refused my offer of money, so one day I took him out to lunch. A few weeks later, he invited me to dinner and took me to my favorite steakhouse. He and his longtime girlfriend were parting ways because she was selling her home and moving to live with her son. We started going out to eat once or twice a week. Abby, after 2 months, he disappeared. I think I fell in love with him without even realizing it. Now he's gone every weekend, and I'm in so much pain. I am trying to set myself free. How could I fall in love so easily? Signed, Wasn't Expecting That. Dear Wasn't Expecting, you were vulnerable, and Stan was there and seemed willing to step in and fill the void left by your husband's death. That's how you fell in love with someone who was, I assume, a long-time trusted friend. Stan may have met someone, have other commitments, or felt unready to make one with you. That he hasn't given you a reason for his disappearance is disappointing, but it happens. Please don't beat yourself up over this. You did nothing wrong. These disappointments are a part of life. Dear Abby, I've been married to a verbally abusive woman for 49 years. To the outside world, she seems perfect, but behind closed doors, she's nasty. She overreacts angrily to the tiniest problem and jumps down my throat when I ask her the simplest question. She complains about my poor memory and hearing. I am 75 and in good shape except for a belly, which she often makes fun of. I have recommended couples therapy, but she refuses to go. Please help me. Signed, Exhausted in Arizona. Dear Exhausted, therapy would be a good idea. Because your wife refuses to go, it might benefit you to talk to a mental health professional. While it won't solve her problems, it could help you get to the bottom of yours. Chief among them would be figuring out the reason you have tolerated your wife's verbal abuse for nearly half a century, and deciding what, if anything, to do about it. Please don't wait. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.